But the goals today are ostensibly different. More science, even habitation. However, as James Oberg points out, space still has geopolitical overtones, and those remain big drivers. And Margaret Race notes that we're in a whole new ballgame in a sense. Today, the ethical implications extend beyond just biological contamination, but to the aesthetics of colonization. It's no longer the Wild West.
Well, thanks to those who put up with our lunacy to help produce this show, Gary Niederhoff, Barbara Vance, and our intern, Aaron Ross.
Also, thanks to financial support from Rena Shulsky David and Sammy David. Big Picture Science is produced at the SETI Institute, a nonprofit scientific and education organization whose scientists study the origin and nature of life. And a big thanks also to our listeners.
Your ears have been attuned to the greater good. If you'd like to moon over more Big Picture Science episodes, well, you'll find them in our archive at bigpicturescience.org.
If you're a podcast listener, but you prefer listening to over-the-air radio because, well, there's some chance that the signal might reach you by bouncing off the moon, check out the listing on our website of radio stations that carry the program. And if your local station is not on that list, consider letting them know you like this show.
Oh, and if you listen by using iTunes, we invite you to leave a review about Big Picture Science on our iTunes page. And to reach us directly with your comments, well, just throw in some faint praise and email it all to bigpicturescience@seti.org.
Just one more, okay?
Okay, you can do one more wheelie in the buggy, but that's all.
WHFR, Dearborn.
The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UFO reality. David Twitchell, and you're listening to WHFR Dearborn. WHFR.FM is the station making waves, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO and abduction phenomenon. And before we get started today, I want to make mention of the fact that this show marks our 11th anniversary with WHFR. Once a year, I like to take a moment just to thank the station for giving me a platform with which to bring the evidence of the UFO phenomenon to the world. I also thank the storied guests we've had on the show, and especially you, the loyal listener, without whom we could not exist. So, I will say happy 11th anniversary to all of us. And that said, a few months ago, we had Bill Murphy on the show to discuss some cornerstone UFO cases, one of which was the 1973 coin helicopter case. But who better to discuss the details and merits of the case than the man who had interviewed some of the principals and ground witnesses personally? Our guest today is Tom Wortman. Tom has had a lifelong interest in the UFO phenomenon and is the state director of the Ohio chapter of the Mutual UFO Network, or MUFON. In the past 7 years, he has conducted more than 300 cases and assisted in cases in the United Kingdom, Canada, and Puerto Rico. including a case that involved two fishermen who experienced more than 3 hours of missing time. Tom has been interviewed on many radio and TV talk shows, participated in two documentaries, and appeared in a short sci-fi film. Recently, as he has opened up about his own personal experiences, and he holds a bachelor degree in business and a master's in education. So, Mr. Tom Wertmann, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dave. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I appreciate you coming on. And if we can, let's just jump right into the coin helicopter case. Give us a background on that.
This is a case I really love because you hear a lot of times about the Rendlesham Forest and Roswell and so forth, but there's a lot of cases going around the country that never really make it to high notoriety. Mm-hmm. And this is one where you, back in 1973, it was October 18th to be exact, you had a National Guard helicopter, or I shouldn't say National Guard, I should say Army Reserve helicopter, that went down to Columbus, Ohio, and some of the crewmen were having just some straight routine medical exams on that day. And about 10:30, they went back to Port Columbus Airport, and they were preparing to come back. They left about 10:30 p.m. approximately. And about 11 p.m., they were near Mansfield, Ohio, when he encountered, I guess you could say, the unknown. The night, I mean, it was completely calm, clear skies out, starry night, moonless. Temperature about 43 degrees, and they had a visibility of 15 miles, which was excellent. Mm-hmm. They're cruising about 90 knots, so it just kind of gives you a little background.
Right.
And about 2,500 feet above sea level, and one thing you have to note about the difference between sea level and ground level is about 1,000 feet difference. So if they're at 2,500 feet above sea level, they're really close to about 1,500 feet above the ground.
Hmm.
And they were just kind of cruising along. Nothing in particular about the flight. I mean, they'd done this trip who knows how many times before. When one of the crewmen, his name was John Healy, mm-hmm. he was the medic on board. He happened to look out the left rear window, and he observed a object way off in the distance, and the object was just a red spherical-shaped light that was non-blinking. And he just watched it, and he thought, well, it could be a radio tower, you know, because if you think about radio towers at night, it could have been, in this case, maybe another aircraft off at a distance. Well, he watched it and never said a word to anybody about it. And the light proceeds to keep going south. They're going north at a bearing of about 30 degrees, and the light goes south and disappears behind them. Well, one of the things that they were doing is they were flying by at night, but also using a little bit of visual ground rules because they were watching an interstate as they were coming back. Now, even though they had their headings that they knew would bring them back to the airport, they could also watch traffic on one of the main interstates.
All right.
And Coyne, along that route, knew that they had to stay kind of on the east side of Route 71, which runs north-south, because as they approached Mansfield, there was a national, or I should say, an Air Guard base over there, Mansfield LOM base, which had fighter jets stationed.
Uh-huh.
And in 1973, they had F-100 fighter jets. So we would make sure he stayed way clear of that. Well, Healy thought it could have been just a random craft, maybe a tower. But when he saw it moving south, he says, okay, I'll just keep an eye on it. But he never said a word to Coyne about it.
Hmm.
Well, this light then disappears. And about 90 seconds later, one of the crewmen on the opposite side of the helicopter, his name was Robert Janicek, he looks out the right side of the helicopter and sees a light off at a distance and behind him. Now, the light appears to be pacing their helicopter. Well, he watches it for about 30 seconds, and then he notifies Coyne, who is the flight commander, and says, you know, Captain, he says, I see a light off at a distance. It looks like it's pacing our helicopter. Well, again, there was concern that maybe this was another aircraft off in a distance. So Coyne told him to keep an eye on it. Well, here we go into that transition to kind of like that B science fiction movie. That light all of a sudden starts turning and it starts heading directly at the helicopter. As it's heading at the helicopter, the crew estimated the speed to be basically just below supersonic. About 600 miles an hour is what they estimated the light started approaching the craft at.
But only one, only one red light, right?
Only one red light. And like, you know, traditional aircraft would have a red and green light, which had been flashing, and this light was solid.
Or a white headlight as well.
Exactly. It also had no strobe on it, but it was just a solid, bright red light.
Okay.
It's approaching maybe about 600 miles an hour from what they estimated. So what Coyne does is when he sees that they're same basic altitude, he starts putting the helicopter into a descent. Now, if you think about it, here they're about 1,500 feet above the ground. And he's trying to get down below it because he thinks initially that this could be one of those fighters coming into Mansfield. Now, on the other hand, he's saying, wait a minute, it couldn't be a fighter because, wait a minute, they're coming at a high rate of speed at an altitude they shouldn't be traveling that speed at. But he just wants to get below this object, whatever it may be. It keeps approaching. And as it gets nearer, he puts the helicopter into the steepest descent that they can get. And the lowest altitude they noted at that point was roughly about 500 feet off the ground. I mean, think about it. They went from 1,500 feet above the ground down to about 500 feet above the ground.
Not very high.
Not very high. And all of a sudden, this green light flares up off the back of this object. And it completely engulfs the helicopter. Now, they can see, the crew can see, that this is a solid object that appears to be disc-shaped. And depending on the perspective, some of the crew thought it may have had like a dome-like structure on the top. It had a bright, brilliant red light in the front, a green light in the back. And they're just kind of there almost a little bit, I guess you could say, in disbelief. And one of the things I like to do is, I mean, you can research things, and you can read books, you can get other resources. But in my case, I wanted to reach out and contact the crewman if possible. Because when I started reading the story, I'm like, man, what better way but to get, you know, direct information from the crew itself? And one of the crew I reached out to was Robert Janicek. I found that he actually lived only about 12 miles from where I live at. So I called him up, and we sat down, and we talked about this in depth. And I said, you know, I said, I'd like to pick up the story at this point. I said, you know, I said, you've got this light in, completely engulfing your helicopter. What was going through your mind? And he goes, you know, we're just kind of, I was just kind of sitting there and just kind of looking up like, wow, check that out. And I said, you know, was it kind of like a Cheech and Chong thing where you're kind of like, dude, look at that thing above me, dude. Wow. And he goes, you know, he says, really, that was almost exactly it.
Give me a hit on that.
Yeah, you know, he says, I'm just looking up and seeing this thing. And it's, he says, it was so close. He says, I thought it was going to hit the rotor blades when it came in.
Wow.
And when this green light flares up, the object also stopped directly above the helicopter. Now, keep in mind, when I say above it, the helicopter is still going forward at approximately 90 knots, which is about 100 miles an hour. They also had put the helicopter into a descent, and they were trying to get below this thing when this light flared up. And if you're wondering, too, I asked them if they tried to contact anybody when this thing started approaching them. They said, yeah. He said, we tried to contact Mansfield. And according to the other crew, they tried to contact Mansfield, and the minute that they keyed the mic up, they transmitted their call sign, which is 15444 was their helicopter tail number. Mansfield, which is only 13 miles from them, acknowledged them. And then the radio went completely dead, and they couldn't raise contact with anybody else. And they kept switching the bands back and forth. They kept trying to make contact. They couldn't make contact with anybody.
And that's
so here they've got no contact with anybody. This object's above them. They're, in theory, going forward and down at the same time. And they're completely focused on this object. Well, they felt no turbulence, nothing whatsoever. And as this object stopped above them, what they didn't realize is they started going up. They started going up in this case from an altitude of approximately 500 feet off the ground to, they noted their altimeter, they were up to 3,500 feet or 2,500 feet above the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So they'd gone up between 1,500 and 2,000 feet.
Wow.
And again, they're totally focused on this thing. And then all of a sudden, they feel themselves break free.
Hmm.
This object, the light went off. The object keeps on going in a similar direction to what it did before. They note their altitude had changed. And what do they do? They said, okay, now let's return back to our normal altitude. So they descend back, in this case, to their normal altitude, 1,500 feet above the ground. And they start reaching out, trying to make contact again with the local airports. And this is where I started finding out some differences in the stories between what I was reading and when I talked to the crewman.
Okay.
When I talked to the crew, I said, you know, I'm reading in a lot of other people's research that this object came and it was basically positioned above the helicopter. Well, when I went back and did some math, I determined it had to be coming at a specific angle. And if it was above, in this case, the helicopter, it had to appear in a certain manner on there. So what I did is I put together a lot of graphics of my visualization of how this thing had to look.
Mm-hmm.
And I sat down, I showed Janacek the original graphics that everybody had been presenting all along, and it was interesting because here, this thing happened in 1973, and he kind of basically almost pushed off in the back of his mind all those years.
Wow.
And he'd never read anybody's books about it. He'd been interviewed a few times about the initial incidents, but other than that, he'd been basically removed from it for all these years.
Did it seem odd that something as traumatic as that could be just filed away in the back of your mind, you know what I'm saying?
Well, you know, there's other things that kind of maybe tied into this whole story that maybe have explained a little bit why.
Mm-hmm.
And I even, of my own personal experiences, I can say that's also kind of a similar thing, too.
Okay.
Because one of the questions that I had for him later on, I said, this helicopter returned down to its normal altitude. You guys continued on to Cleveland. I said, did you ever have anything, and this is kind of jumping ahead a little bit, I said, did you ever have any weird dreams about out-of-body experiences? And he goes, no. And I said, well, did Captain Coyne ever call you and ask you about any weird dreams? He goes, yeah, he did.
Really?
He wanted to know if I was having weird dreams. Well, Coyne had had unusual dreams of out-of-body experiences.
Hmm.
And the information I had is it basically came down from the upper echelons of the military, that when Coyne started talking about it, they asked Coyne, they kept following up with Coyne, but they also had him touch base with his crewmen to see if they were also having dreams of out-of-body experiences.
The military wanted to know this.
Yes, the military wanted to know that.
Hmm.
And Janacek told me, he says, I didn't know why, but it kind of seemed like a really odd question to ask me out of him. It came like out of left field, associated with this. And I said, well, because he'd been having experiences. So maybe in this time frame, that when this object came towards him, intercepted their craft, maybe they also had some incident of missing time.
All right.
And who knows what may have happened in there and also extended into making them kind of forget a little bit about things.
Was there any indication that there was missing time? Were they late getting back to their base? Or?
I'm glad you brought that up. What a segue.
Okay.
Well, that was one of the things that you don't see. When I started talking to him about this whole thing, I go, you know, I said, I heard that you know, you were basically this object that was in front of you. I said, did it feel like it was pulling you up? And I asked a normal questions associated with maybe almost like something, assuming like a tractor beam, something that's activating this craft or affecting this craft.
Mm.
And he goes, well, it wasn't long after that, he says, all of a sudden we got a master caution light lighting up on the control panel.
Mm.
And I said, master caution light for what? He goes, low fuel.
Low fuel.
Low fuel. And he says, it came on when we had roughly about 20 minutes of reserve fuel left.
Mm.
I said, now, you'd flown this route, or Coin had, hundreds of times. They fueled up in Cleveland, went to Columbus and back, which is about 315, the helicopter has a range of about 315, 320 miles, and that would have used only about 200 and a little over 200 miles worth of fuel. So in theory, they may have used maybe two-thirds of the tank with plenty to get back.
Mm-hmm.
But he says the master caution light started coming on. And he says we were able to regain contact with, like, one of the airports, but they weren't able to contact Cleveland where they were heading.
Hmm.
And they were concerned that they were going to be running out of fuel quick. So when they came in and they sat down and landed, he says all of a sudden they had trucks coming up to wonder who had landed without permission. Because they had no clearance to technically land. And they only had just a couple of minutes of fuel left when they sit on the ground. And he says the thing that scared him the most of all the times he'd been flying was how close we're out of fuel on that trip.
Wow. So time-wise, there wasn't any indication, but fuel-wise, there was.
That's right. Time-wise, it didn't seem like there was.
Right.
Hmm. And go ahead.
No, I was just going to say that, that's kind of typical in UFO abduction cases that they seem to be in another time zone, you know, where either the time is, it seems like 10 minutes has passed when 2 hours has passed, or some other indication, like the fuel, you know.
Mm-hmm.
People who have been going along down road A and 2 minutes later they're on road B, which is 20 miles away from where they were 10 minutes ago or 2 minutes ago.
Right.
You know, so that type of thing, even though the time is the same. So
right. That's what they said, the time seemed the same, but...
Right.
To me, it almost makes me believe, on one hand, that maybe they were missing time in a sense without missing time, I guess you could
say. Right, right, right. There's some indication of something was missing. Right now, I have to just take a moment just to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, 89.3 FM on your radio, and WHFR.FM on your computers. And you are listening to We Are Not Alone. I am David Twitchell, and we're speaking with the state director for the Ohio chapter of the Mutual UFO Network, or MUFON, and that is Tom Wortman. We're talking about the 1973 Coin helicopter case. Please continue with your analysis of this, Tom.
Okay. Well, one of the things... I was questioning Yanicek about, because he was also the crew chief. And I said, you know, I said, the radio went out. And I said, I was doing a program. I told him I was doing a program at a library a couple years before. And I was talking about a totally different UFO case when a gentleman in the audience asked me to describe this particular case here, the Coin case. And I said, it took about 5 minutes. And I said, once I got done... I asked the gentleman in the audience, I said, did that explanation answer your question? He goes, yes, it did. That was the way it happened.
Hmm.
And I don't know about you, Dave, but when somebody says that was the way it happened, it kind of gets your attention real quick.
Yeah, how do you know?
And I almost tackled the guy before he got out the door. I said, how do you know so much about the case? And it was John Healy, one of the other crewmen.
Ah.
He was vacationing in the region at the time. And he just happened to saw UFO talk, and he came in to see what it was all about.
Wow.
And I asked Healy, and he actually even volunteered at first. And he says, well, you know, that helicopter became a hangar queen after that day.
Hangar queen.
Hangar queen. I said, what do you mean hangar queen? And I had a rough indication what it meant. He goes, well, radio never worked right. Compass never worked right. As a matter of fact, they had to pull the compass the day after this whole thing happened because the compass kept spinning around in a circle.
Mm.
So they replaced the compass, but he said it kept having issues electronically with that helicopter ever after that event.
Mm-hmm.
That was the same thing that Janáček also told me, that helicopter kept having mechanical issues after that whole incident.
And they just couldn't use it again.
At least they could use it, but the gear wouldn't hold up.
Yeah.
And I said, well, also, I understand that they did a check on the rotor blades the following day. I said, isn't that kind of unusual that they would take the blades and look for cracks in the blades the day after an event like this?
Hmm.
And he says, well, he said it was like a routine schedule thing, which I kind of find that hard to believe when they're looking for fractures in rotor blades after a helicopter has been involved with another object at very close range and going from 500 feet off the ground to 2,500 feet off the ground.
Yeah.
If something was pulling it up, maybe somebody's looking for fractures that they might have expected.
Stress on the metal.
Exactly, because they did Magnaflux test and they found nothing in that particular area.
Hmm. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
So you talk more to this Healy, and what other information did he have, if any?
Well, he was just very adamant about the fact. He says the helicopter became a hangar queen. And I said, well, question. I said, does the military get upset about you talking about this?
Hmm.
And he goes, as long as they state exactly what happened.
Hmm.
Now, all the crew filled out a deposition when they came back, stating that basically they had an object intercept them. They descended to try to get below it. They ended up going up in altitude and ended up breaking free.
Hmm.
And he goes, as long as I state that's exactly what happened, nobody has an issue.
So the military is, in effect, saying, as long as you tell the truth? That's kind of odd, isn't it?
Well, it's kind of odd, but then again, they made no claims, especially Dave Janáček. He was there, and he basically said, I don't know what it was.
Yeah.
In our terms, it was a UFO.
Right. Right. Now, I'm being facetious when I say that's odd that the military wants you to tell the truth, but
well,
at the same time, as long as you don't speculate as to, you know, it was E.T. from the planet Melmac or something, you know. And,
exactly.
Right. So, okay. So what was the official explanation as to what happened, if any? Or did they bury it and say nothing happened? Nothing to see here, move out.
You had some explanations. You had Philip Klass back at that time, who was one of the main skeptics. He came out and said, well, this object that they had coming at them, it had to be a meteor. Now, here the object comes at them from, or heading south, I should say, to begin with,
mm-hmm.
makes a turn to the right.
Mm-hmm.
Not quite 90 degrees, but probably mm-hmm. about 70 degrees. Next thing you know, it makes another turn, heads back north at a steeper angle, and then approaches them again from another angle.
Mm-hmm.
So it basically loops around this helicopter.
Hmm.
Now, I don't know. Maybe I'm not too creative an astronomer, but I've never really seen a meteor that can make a complete circular turn.
And then hovered above the helicopter.
No, and pause above the helicopter,
right.
And this whole time frame lasted roughly about 5 minutes. Now, fireball is nothing. I've never seen anything last that long.
No.
And that was one of the main explanations on here. And also, Philip Klass came out and said, well, maybe they're also hoaxing it because, see, at the same time, this is when the National Enquirer was one of those great supermarket magazines you could pick up that's going through checkout.
All right. The yellow rag, I call them.
Oh, yes. And the National Enquirer picked up on their story, and they awarded the crew like $5,000 for best UFO story of the year.
Hmm.
So another explanation was it had to be hoaxed because the National Enquirer publicized it and gave them money. But COIN actually went as far as wanting to be more vocal about it. He actually went to a meeting of the United Nations trying to push for, you know, people to get more involved in the subject of UFOs.
Right.
And he was there with Alan Hynek and Jacques Vallée.
Right.
That but, was, again, it got eventually buried and went nowhere.
That was the only congressional hearing that was done on UFOs, to my knowledge, correct?
Yes, my knowledge, too.
Now, Stanton Friedman.
But really, it ended up getting buried.
Yeah.
And when you sit down and you talk to the crew like I did, I mean, it leaves a distinct impression on you.
But that, the hoax theory doesn't hold water because unless they're saying the military is hoaxing it, not just the crew members, but the military.
Exactly. When I talked to Yanichik, he says, you know, really he didn't have any opinions of it. He just remembers getting the paycheck or the money from the Enquirer cashing it and never thought about the hoax.
That could be a setup, too, you know. Go ahead and you know, saying to, the government saying to the National Enquirer, go ahead and pay them. In fact, here's the money. Go ahead and pay them. That way we can say, ah, he got money for the story. That's why MUFON, well, I don't have to tell you, MUFON never pays for, I'm telling the listeners, MUFON never pays for a UFO story. We welcome all UFO encounters, your accounts, you know, but we're not going to pay you for it because that way the Philip Classes of the world, you know, may he rest in peace, the Philip Classes of the world are going to say, aha, they got paid for that story. It must be a hoax.
And I'm glad you mentioned that because in the last week I've gotten two individuals who wanted to sell me pictures of the best UFO picture ever. And I said, I'm interested in looking at them, but I said, I'll look at them, but I'm not paying you any money at all.
Yeah, I remember, I mentioned this on this show before a few years ago. A couple young guys, 21, 22 years old, had a UFO hover right over their houses, over their house. And a guy grabs his cell phone, snaps a picture, you know. Excellent picture. And he wanted to sell it to MUFON. He wanted, I don't know, $50, $500. I don't know what he wanted. But he wanted to sell it to him because this is, in his words, evidence that UFOs existed. Excuse me, do you know how many pictures are out there? A lot of them are even real, you know?
Oh, exactly.
Yeah. A lot of hoaxes on YouTube and what have you, but we're able to pick out the hoaxes from the real thing. And
especially with this technology we've got available now.
Yeah.
You mentioned that, and I got a picture in from a witness that was eventually turned out to be Chinese lanterns.
Yeah.
He sent me a photograph. He told me where he was standing at. And I sent him back an email, says, I'm sorry, but you showed me a picture of a light pole. The light pole you're standing in front of is 9 miles away from where you told me you're standing at. I told him exactly where he was standing at, the angle he was looking, the angle his camera was at, and all the camera settings because I'd pulled the information from his photograph. And it's like, okay, you can't even be honest with me.
Yeah. I had that happen once on a case I was investigating that... turned out to be the light was right on their property, you know, not far from their porch. And I don't know what the man saw because he was out in his car somewhere away from the house, and he called his wife. He says, I'm looking at this light in the sky, and go out and look in this area and snap a picture of it if you see it. And she snaps his picture. They sent me the picture. And I'm looking at the shape of that thing, and I enhanced it a bit and saw it was a light post. So I called him. I called him and I said, I think it was an honest mistake on her part. She just took a picture of that area, and he saw this grand light, white light, you know. And he said, that must be it. Sends it to me. I said, now go out on your porch and look out there. What do you see? Oh, God. He couldn't get off the phone fast enough. He was so embarrassed.
So embarrassment's what he saw.
Yeah. So he may have seen a real UFO, but his wife arbitrarily took a picture of the light, of the street light, you know. Oh, well, it happens, you know. And
it does. And it can happen out there.
Like really I say, 85%, 80 to 85% can be explained of these sightings, but it's the remainder that can't be explained that we're interested in, right?
Well, that's why in the Coyne case, too, what I liked is I also ran into another number of ground witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And some were even just by matter of chance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when you talk about a small world,
mm-hmm.
We were doing a conference in Ashland, which is about right on the edge of where the sighting started at.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were setting up for a conference, we went to bar a bunch of chairs. And I'm borrowing chairs from a volunteer fire department. And I'm talking to one of the firemen I knew. I've known him for some time. And he says, what are you talking about? I said, well, I'm talking about the Coyne case. He goes, oh, I saw that UFO that night.
Hmm.
I said, what? And he told me exactly where he was at with about 20 other people. And they were kind of all doing things that you shouldn't have been doing at that time frame. Again, you have to remember it was kind of like a Cheech and Chong era a little bit. And they were out partying, too. And they also looked up and said, kind of like, dude.
Give me a hit.
Yeah, and they said they saw it off in the distance, and they saw the object intercept the helicopter and leave.
Mm-hmm.
And he says there were about 20 of us that night. There was also another family that was even closer. So, I mean, here you've got not only the Army Reserve crew, but you've got a high number of ground witnesses also reporting the same thing.
Wow. So, you know, how can the skeptics deny that with so many people coming forward? This has to be a conspiracy to perpetrate a hoax on the world, you know?
Yeah, and to me, I mean, when you've got the skeptics, I mean, you're never going to convince certain people of certain facts, no matter how hard you try.
All right, I got you.
So I'm not even going to try to convince myself, say, this is just a data I have. You show me your data otherwise.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's all we can do, you know?
Well, the data about the fireball, or that's wild. But, you know, people will accept that explanation because that's better than saying there's a more intelligent species out there that's checking in on us and...
Yeah.
You know?
That's right. We're not alone.
We're not alone. And why would that be scary? What was it? Author. I can't think of his name right now. And I will after the show. But he's, you know how that goes. But he said, we are either alone in the universe or we're not. Both are equally as frightening.
That's right.
You know? So, at any rate, let me take a moment once again to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, 89.3 FM. And you are listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, and we're speaking with State Director for the Mutual UFO Network, Mr. Tom Wortman. We're talking about the 73 Coyne helicopter case. And Tom, do you think it was possible that the UFO took that helicopter up so high because they thought it was going to crash?
Well, you know, we talked about that, I think, up in Michigan when we came to the MUFON Michigan meeting.
Right.
And it's one of those kind of like revelations you have years later that everybody talks about them diving below to get below this object.
Mm-hmm.
But what's to say these individuals, if there were individuals on that object, what was going through their mind? Like, these people are idiots. They're trying to crash their helicopter. And maybe if that craft was under intelligent control, maybe it saw the helicopter diving, especially getting close proximity to the ground, and maybe that's why it pulled it up.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there was a reason behind it on there.
Wow.
And I think that's very, very plausible.
But they should realize you come that close to one of us, we panic, you know?
Normally.
And then they've been there thinking, well, we're not going to hurt you. Yeah, but we don't know that.
but I think that is a plausible explanation,
right,
on why that happened. And then once they got them up to basically a safe altitude, they kind of released them and let them go.
That was pretty high for a helicopter, wasn't it?
Yeah, they were, well, they could have gone much higher than that.
Really?
But they were about 2,500 feet up.
Mm-hmm.
Their cruising altitude typically is, I think, about 1,500 feet, right, something like that.
But, I mean, normally that would be high for a helicopter.
Yeah, that'd be high up. Yeah.
It's better than being 500 feet lower, right?
That's correct. That is correct.
Be hitting the deck. Yeah. So, what other information, if any, do you have on this case?
Well, I've been digging, and to begin with, I'm really fascinated with this case because I've also had some past experiences myself.
Okay. Do you mind sharing those with us?
It's really sucked me into this. But when I started digging into it, I found an article saying, that this helicopter had crashed. Because I thought, you know, if I could find this helicopter, what if it's sitting in a museum? What if it's sitting on display someplace? I think it'd be great to go back even all these years later and maybe get an opportunity to look at it and see if there are any lasting effects.
Mm-hmm.
An article I found showed it had crashed in Colombia in roughly about 2009.
The same helicopter?
Same helicopter, because I went back through FAA records.
Okay.
And found out that the helicopter had been basically grounded for a while, and I could not find out the reasons why it was grounded.
Mm-hmm.
Then they'd given it to the Colombian government, and in the process they'd taken away its military ID, assigned it a civilian ID number. The civilian ID number is transferred over to the Colombian government.
Mm.
And they were using it for drug trafficking raids down in Colombia.
Mm.
And I kind of thought the story died there. And then all of a sudden I started Googling the number of the Colombian helicopter. And I picked up some documents in WikiLeaks.
Mm.
And the documents were communications between Colombia and our government regarding the drug trafficking raids down there. The progress, the helicopters, we'd given them X number of helicopters, what they'd been doing each month.
Mm-hmm.
And it was almost like getting reports back from Vietnam, if you almost pictured it.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, they were spraying, not this particular helicopter, but other helicopters were spraying herbicides to kill the foliage, in this case, pot.
Mm-hmm.
Also, they'd had helicopters going in, flying coverage, because they were receiving fire from the rebels down there, protecting their crops. And this one was a medevac helicopter, which had been kept as a medevac helicopter, so they're probably using it to transport people out that were injured.
Mm-hmm.
And when I thought the report initially had died, and when I saw the helicopter crash to the same tail number, I thought that was in a story, but when I found these WikiLeaks documents, they showed no tail number by this one going down.
Hmm.
They showed another one the same month with a different tail number going down, but nothing regarding this one.
Hmm.
And it kind of really made me wonder, wait a minute, did this thing go down or not? Did they do something to make this helicopter basically disappear?
Hmm.
Fake, there'd be no evidence left over.
Fake its death, in other words.
Exactly, fake its death.
Hmm.
And I'm briefly really trying to find ways now to see if I can dig up more information on that particular area.
So you never...
What I was really trying to go after is like maintenance records and all the other things along with that, too.
So you're in the process, but you never really got an answer on that, right?
No. Yeah. And I've tried emailing some down in that region, and I'm getting no response back.
Is that surprising?
No. Not surprising at all.
Wow. So, okay. So, Now, as not to change the subject, but as you indicated, as I indicated at the top of the show, you have recently opened up about your own personal UFO experiences. And would you mind sharing some of those details with our listeners?
No. And I think a lot of it's why I'm so enthralled in this field.
Yeah.
And also it ties back into what you made a comment about one of the crewmen earlier. Why would they kind of just bury this in the back of their mind for years?
Mm-hmm.
Well, back in the 1960s, I lived in Ohio, and our family moved to South Carolina right around the middle 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
And we used to go out, me and some buddies had telescopes, and we used to go out and watch the sky every night. And on one night, that was when I could basically say I saw my first UFO, which doesn't mean it didn't have an explanation, but I saw this light coming up beside another, what appeared to be like an aircraft flying. It approached at a high rate of speed, matched its speed, and then took off and left it in a cloud of dust, basically.
Hmm.
And we were just watching kind of in disbelief that night. Well, it wasn't long after that I started having bouts of sleep paralysis.
Hmm.
I'd wake up, or I guess you could say feel like I'm coming awake, and I couldn't move. No matter what.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't just one time. It was like almost like a nightly event, night after night after night. Along with this, I started getting a lot of paranoia that something was coming for me. And it was always coming from a certain direction away from our house in a wooded area.
You had this paranoia while you were temporarily paralyzed in bed?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I felt then a number of times, like you heard a lot of people describe, it was like they were being elevated, going up.
Mm-hmm.
But I just felt something was coming towards me, and I couldn't move. I couldn't do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
Other nights, I mean, every time I'd go to bed at night, I'd start checking the room over 20, 30 times to make sure there was nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
And I started developing medical problems associated with ulcers. I started developing ulcers extremely bad that they couldn't figure out why a kid my age would have a medical condition that serious.
How old were you at the time?
I was only right around at that time. That would make me around 10, 12 years old.
Okay.
12 years old. And I got, I mean, they were getting intense. I'd be rolling on the ground. I was in so much pain.
Wow.
They had hospitalized me, I don't know how many times at that point, three times or something like that it was, for like a week at a time. And they could not get the things to go away.
Huh.
And it kept building. Well, we relocated to another area in South Carolina, farther out into the country from what we were.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a relatively rural area, not much around, but a few houses. And one of my friends I'd developed a good bond with, we used to say we're going to go out on our hunting expeditions. Well, for us, hunting was getting shotguns, going out through the peach orchards, clear back into the woods, and we would take and probably hunt every Frigidaire, Maytag, any appliance that was abandoned in the field. And that's what we end up shooting most of the time. I don't remember killing animals. I remember hitting appliances.
I see.
They didn't move.
Right. Right. Easy
on
targets.
Trips,
and
we went behind my friend. House. It was probably like 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
Mm-hmm.
Bright, sunny sky. I remember that distinctly.
Mm-hmm.
We're going clear back in this woods. I don't know how many miles we went back in. And at that time, it was probably about 13, I think. And I remembered going through the woods, and the woods went completely silent.
Huh.
And I'm walking along. I didn't really pay that much attention to it. My buddy, who was 2 years older than I was, he started kind of panicking. He says, hey, do you hear anything? I said, no, I don't hear nothing. He goes, that's the problem, man. I don't hear nothing.
Hmm.
And he started telling me, under Dave, about this beast they called the swamp bully back in there, because it was also, there was a lot of swamps in that region.
Hmm.
I'm like, swamp bully? What is a swamp bully, man? He goes, well, it's, he described basically a Bigfoot. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, you're trying to tell me a campfire story to scare me. It's not going to work. I've got a shotgun. I'm not worried. Well, we kept walking deeper back in the woods, but then it was on this day I looked up, and above the treetops, I saw a silver dish-shaped object just hovering above the trees. which are probably maybe like 60 feet up, something like that.
Mm.
I'm looking at this silver disc shaped object, never said a word to him about it.
Huh.
And we just keep walking back in the woods, and he's panicking because he's getting more nervous because of the quiet. And I'm watching this disc shaped craft. Mm. And we keep walking deeper and deeper into the woods. Well, he starts really getting upset, and he wants to get out of there, so he picks the pace way up. And instead of turning back around and heading towards our houses, he goes deeper into the woods.
Hmm.
Well, I'm just watching this object, and for some reason, I said, okay, whatever, it's there. It hasn't done nothing to me, so I guess let's just keep going, you know? And I quit paying attention to it. And then all of a sudden, when we got out into an opening, I don't know how much longer after that was, we get an opening, we found a little small road, which was barely a paved road, pretty much just had like tar on the top of it, a dirt road of tar.
Mm-hmm.
We hit that road and we started walking back. He goes, that big white owl we saw back there, man.
Mm-hmm.
And he starts talking about this huge white owl that was materialized in front of us. And I said, what are you talking about, a big white owl? And I never mentioned what I saw. He mm-hmm. goes, no, there's this big white owl standing in front of us.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept repeating over and over and over again the whole way home about this thing. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember seeing anything like that.
How old was he at the time?
He was 15.
Yeah.
And I was about 13. Now, mm-hmm. for some reason, I'd never, ever mentioned to him about seeing the object above the trees.
Mm-hmm.
But he kept telling me about the white owl that was in front of us that I never saw.
Mm-hmm. Did he say just how big that owl was?
Well, it wasn't like full human height. It was bigger than a normal owl, but it wasn't a human height.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess you could say it was kind of like in between.
Because I've heard stories from, not personally, but I've heard of abductees claiming to see a four-foot owl.
I think by comparison, I'd probably say you're probably right about what he was describing. Is probably about 4 foot roughly in there.
Okay.
He said it was not a normal owl, but he says it wasn't a full human height.
Right.
And he was just adamant over and over again about the white owl.
Hmm.
We got back home. He never talked any more about that. I never told him about seeing what I did above, in this case, the trees.
Mm-hmm.
And it was not long after that that, I mean, my paranoia even started flipping out, even going more. When I would go to bed at night, I would have to start, I was still, by the way, going through the sleep paralysis.
Mm-hmm.
But I would start covering up the around the curtains. I would put sheets and stuff over the curtains, everything I could to cover the windows up as much as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Constantly checking the whole room out every single night.
Oh.
And it was just, I mean, incredible paranoia that something was still coming towards me or coming for me.
Mm-hmm. Do you have that?
And
go ahead.
All those years, you know, I went through that. We also had a bout where, I don't know if I told you before about this, but the closest comparison you can come to is a Men in Black.
Mm-hmm.
It was very shortly after this time that happened. I was sitting in my house, and we'd look out and we'd see a car start pulling in our drive every night, shining its lights in our front house, night after night after night.
Mm-hmm.
And it was you could see the outline, again, back as a kid. I mean, we pretty much knew a lot of the cars on the road by the shape of the headlights at night.
Mm-hmm.
And this, no kidding, was a Ford Galaxy.
Really?
And it kept shining its headlights and light out, in the house. I don't know why my parents would never call the sheriff or anybody to take, you know, find out why.
Mm-hmm.
But they would pull in, they would shine the lights in, stay there 5 or so minutes, and then back out and leave. Well, one night, me and my buddy decided to walk up to a filling station, probably about a half mile to mile away, get something to drink. It was after dark. And on our way back, we're going down this dirt road, and we hear a car coming behind us, and we turn around and look, and we don't see any lights, but we can see the outline of a car coming down the road. It starts coming close towards us, so we run off the road up through what they call kudzu vines, which is a really dense foliage
mm-hmm.
that you can't really run through. You just kind of hop, try to hop through it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we got off into like a peach orchard area. And this car had come down, going up the embankment, this dirt bank, as far as it could up towards the vines and trying to go up through that way towards us.
Hmm.
We're back down into the road and then took off and we never saw it again.
Wow.
But we had the impression it was coming after us.
Oh, yeah. Sounds like it was.
Yeah, and all these events, I mean, there were a number of other events along with this. After I left South Carolina, I remembered them. I had a few other ones after that, but not as often.
Mm-hmm.
But I just kind of brushed off the back of my mind for years and never put a correlation anything on there.
Mm-hmm. Are you still having these experiences? Are you still having these sleep paralysis? Or
not sleep paralysis anymore. But at times now what I get is sometimes I'll get feelings when I get around certain cases I'm involved with.
Hmm.
Like you mentioned earlier, you know, 80, 85% or so we can explain.
Mm-hmm.
But those ones that you get, which are really unique and really unusual,
mm-hmm.
sometimes I want to get around them. I just know something for sure happened,
uh-huh.
and I can just feel it completely through my body.
Right.
I was doing a missing time case in southern Ohio back in 2014,
uh-huh.
where two fishermen lost roughly about 3.5 hours of missing time. One was in his 40s, the other was like 19 years old.
Mm.
And it came in as a star team case for MUFON, which meant it was very high priority.
Mm.
I called the fishermen up, got them to go back down the same night that they came back, and relive the whole experiences down there.
Mm.
And when we were down in that region, walking through the state park, one area that we were at, the 19-year-old was just like, he was kind of like Barney Fife. he didn't have a single bullet with him, but he was just bouncing up and down just like Barney Fife, as hyper as he was. Any little sound he heard in the woods, he was just about to jump out of his socks.
Wow.
And these guys had fished in that same area for 2 years.
Hmm.
And almost every weekend the weather was nice. You were down there, like, why would you be that nervous?
Mm-hmm.
Well, one time in particular, he heard a noise. My whole body started basically like burn from top to bottom. I could feel like a burning sensation.
Hmm.
I'm like, And I'd never said a word to him about it. The following weekend, I went back down, number one, to see if their story was true, because they claimed that they had not gone back down fishing. So I thought, let's see if I can catch them down there. And they weren't down there that day. But I walked that whole region myself, the area where they were at, and then I went to a totally different area of the park.
Mm-hmm.
It was about 200 feet from where they were at, around a whole big line of trees. And when I approached that area, all of a sudden I just lit up like a Christmas tree. And the immediate thought that went through my mind is whatever happened right here.
Hmm.
Well, this week I got back some initial results of soil samples I'd sent out some time ago.
Mm-hmm.
And on the soil samples I sent back, they found a much higher iron content in one of the particular areas that it was at.
Wow. What did the person
I got doing the research for me said that there's been other cases that she's received samples from, that wherever something has come down, like almost like a landing,
uh-huh.
That there's been a much higher iron content in the soil for whatever reason.
So there is physical evidence to substantiate a lot of these cases, huh?
And I wouldn't say a lot of them, but in this case, we got not only that, but we also I got the clothing from the fishermen. And on one of the fishermen's clothes,
mm-hmm.
We found something that appeared to be biological.
Really?
It fluoresced under a black light. We don't know exactly what it is yet, but it appears biological in nature.
Jeez. I'm afraid we're running out of time right now, Tom, but where can our listeners go to find out more about your work and Ohio MUFON?
Well, They can go to our website at MUFONofOhio.com. It's just actually MUFONofOhio.com. And they'll find schedules for our local meetings down there. We're looking at having a conference in September this year. We're laying out our plans right now for it. And that's one of the ways to get a hold of me. I'm also with another group called the Cleveland Ufology Project, which is a small group out of Cleveland, but we're actually the oldest group in the world, established in 1952, and we've been meeting since 1952. And if they go to clevelandufo.com, that's where they can find information on that group.
Beautiful. Very good. So it's basically Ohio MUFON, right?
Ohio MUFON. And we actually have a week meeting coming up this Sunday in Westerville, Ohio, at the Westerville Public Library.
Very good. Very good. Tom Wertman, I want to thank you so much for joining us. And maybe we can get together and do this again sometime.
That sounds great. I'd appreciate it.
We'll get into a lot of the Ohio cases.
Sounds good.
Okay. Thanks again, Tom. Take care.
Thank you.
And if our listeners have any questions or comments for me, you can email me at dtwitchell@hotmail.com. This show, as well as all the forum shows, is now archived at whfr.fm's website. Click on Talk Shows on the homepage, and then Tuesday Forum. We Are Not Alone is also archived at my website, which is ufoimplications.com. Please stay tuned to whfr.fm, the station making waves for the best in alternative programming. I want to thank you for joining us today. Please join us again the first Tuesday of each month at 1 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UFO phenomenon. Until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.
WHFR Dearborn.
Yo, guys and dolls, you're at the malt shop with Daddy G here in WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And we're going back to the 50s and 60s today, again. And so hang those fuzzy dice on the rearview mirror, grab your favorite squeeze, and head on down to the malt shop, where the jukebox is playing, the kids are dancing. And here we are, back in the 50s.
Honeycomb, honeycomb.
Well, it's a darn good life, and it's kind of funny how the Lord made the bee, and the bee made the honey, and the honey bee looking for